are looking at the core architecture that we are going to design to try to understand all of these new products and codes. This is based on decentralization. This is decentralization of the computer systems themselves. We're going to create what we call decentralized ledger technology, DLT. That means that we have multiple copies of the original operating program held in a large number of separate computers across the world. That creates its own computer connected network. We call that DLT, decentralized ledger technology. There is a single ledger, but it's held in multiple copies in large number of different systems sets around the world. In the Bitcoin example, there are around 1 million nodes. That's core computers that have downloaded the full blockchain and can have access to all of their transactions on the blockchain, as well as can run and operate the blockchain. These are called nodes. So this is DLT. The key objective is that we avoid single point of access and single point of failure by having multiple copies of a program running on separate systems across the world. This is what DLT is for. There is an issue that you have multiple points of access and possibly multiple points of failure, but because it's decentralized, that's not such an issue, as well as the cryptography and the transaction hashing we'll come on to mention mean that we get a lot more security within the system anyway. So we're going to digitalize, we're going to disintermediate, and we're going to decentralize. That's point number one. We then have asset digitalization. We are going to create a whole series of new digital assets. Valuable, commercial, financial, cultural items that only exist on these new systems, on blockchain or on graph technology, which we referred to before. So we have asset digitalization. We're creating, whether it's coins or smart contracts or other property items, they are digital in nature. So it's digital creation, digital origination, asset digitalization. At the same time, we have identity digitalization. We need to digitalize the people, we need to digitalize ourselves to operate on these systems. So we need to then look at various forms of how can we actually participate on an online system, how can we be a member and operate, as well as prove and validate our own identity. So we need to look at various forms of digital identification, as well as digital contract, contract execution, contract validation. So we need to consider all of these new issues in terms of identification, but in a digital system. We then have authentication and access cryptography. We need to control the access to the systems. We do that through cryptography. The most commonly used form is dual public-private key or elliptic public-private key cryptography. Public-private key means this. We have a public key which is available on the internet that can be used to validate that a private key has been used properly, or a person has used the private key and that that was legitimate. The private key is the confidential key. It's the secret key where we actually keep the item of value. So for example, if you own a Bitcoin, technically what you have, what you possess, is the private key that has the digital record that evidences that Bitcoin. So that's held in your private key address. You will then use the public key to access the private key. If you're going to sell or transfer the Bitcoin, you don't actually move the Bitcoin, you just pass on the private key. So the next person acquires the same private key and then they can use that. More commonly in practice, the system will actually generate a new private key into which the value is created. So you will then acquire that new private key, that will become your new property item. Strictly speaking, it's not property, it's only a digital entry. It's a digital record, and this then raises very significant complex problems with law and property law and how we can revise property law going forward. I've written a very large paper on exactly this, and what I do is this. I create a new form of what I call an attachment theory. What this simply means is this. Even if we have an intangible entry on our paper ledger or a digital ledger, can that become property? Now, I will argue it can become property if we can attach a series of rights to that. If, for example, is it identifiable? Is it specific? Is it permanent? Can we control it? And then in terms of control, I've got five conditions. Can we use or exercise it? Can we bequest it? Can we transfer it by gift or sale? Can we charge it? And can we destroy it? If this thing on our blockchain, if we can do all of these things with regards to that item, therefore that exists as a form of property under this new theory of attachment and control rights that I am constructing in this area. And I'll give you a copy of the separate property paper. So what we're doing is this. We have access cryptography is going to control the access to the system. And then on the system, we're actually going to move property items. Under many legal systems, these do not yet exist as property. The law in a number of countries is still confused in this area, but what we can do is this. We can construct a new definition of property that allows us to identify any intangible item, including an entry on a digital system, a digital ledger, that can be property if it satisfies certain conditions. I call these the title conditions. If it's specific, permanent, identifiable, and exclusive, if we can control it. And then in terms of the actual control rights themselves, I have five. Can we use it? Can we exercise it? Can we charge it? Can we bequeath it? Can we transfer it by gift or sale? And can we destroy it? Under my argument, if we can do all of these things with regards to anything which includes an entry on a digital ledger, it is property. The issue that arises with regards to these new systems is that technically you cannot destroy a Bitcoin. The Bitcoin will always exist on the system. What will happen is if you lose, or the last person who was in possession of the private key loses control or access or a record to that, if they lose that, the property item still exists, but they can't access it. And because they can't access it, they can't control it. We actually think there's a large amount of value that's lying dormant in these digital systems because people have lost the private keys. Now, the way we solve that in practice is that we have wallets. We have digital wallets which hold not value, the wallet holds the private keys. So, on my telephone, for example, or on my computer, I have at least two wallets. I can transfer to the wallet whether it's my Bitcoin or my Ethereum or my whatever else. Technically, I am not holding the asset itself on the wallet. It's not the value that's in the wallet. The wallet holds the private keys. It becomes a little bit more complex in practice because what actually happens is this. If you're holding one Bitcoin or someone transfers one Bitcoin to you, very often that Bitcoin is actually made up of a large number of separate transfers from other transactions. So it's not one Bitcoin you have. You may have 100 fractions of a Bitcoin, which by coincidence add up to one Bitcoin. So in your wallet, you won't actually have a single address holding the Bitcoin. You will have 100 separate addresses, which if you add them all up, makes one Bitcoin. So the wallets are records of entitlement to these assets. These are technically the only record entries which evidence a certain value, and by aggregating, adding them up together, you can work out how many Bitcoin or other digital asset you hold at any one point in time. I'll come back and mention wallets in a couple of minutes. With regards to wallets, we can have cold wallets and we can have cold wallets and hot wallets, warm wallets. A hot wallet is something online. So you can keep your digital coin in a hot wallet online. The problem is someone can access that wallet and then steal your entry. If they steal your private key, they steal your Bitcoin. That's how you can lose them. So very often what people do is they have cold wallets. So that's something offline. It might be a USB clip, it might be a piece of paper, it might be some other record, whereby if you hold a large amount of Bitcoin, You may not want it to leave it in a hot wallet that other people can access and possibly steal, so you'll transfer it offline and keep it in a separate system. There are a number of incidents of people losing their Bitcoin. There was one gentleman managed to throw his drive away, which was holding a large number of Bitcoin, and the value on this Bitcoin was completely irrecoverable. And he lost millions. So we have decentralization, asset digitalization, individual identity digitalization, and then access cryptography. What we're saying is this. You have dual public-private key. The public key evidences the use of the private key. It's the private key that you hold the actual access to the blockchain, which will have the entry, the digital entry, which is the value that we're concerned with in any particular case. Longer term, or in other possible use applications of this, we talk about real assets or real coins or representative coins. What that means is this: we can hold any asset that's already on an existing ledger on a blockchain. So we can transfer land registers, car registers, shipping registers, securities registers. We can hold those on blockchains. In that case, the item isn't valuable. It's not an entry of value as such. It doesn't say one Bitcoin or two Ethereum. It says that you own this house or this car or this whatever else. So we can also use these digital entries to create what we call real tokens. In the language of Bitcoin, it's called a colored coin. That's where you have a digital entry which represents another item of property off the ledger of the item. On the access public-private key cryptography. We also call it, sometimes we refer to this in terms of elliptic dual public-private key cryptography. An elliptic curve is a more complex curve. It's not a simple line, it's a curve. And the reason it's got a curve is that you can then get more intersections. Because we can have more intersections, we can create more complex cryptography that supports that. It just makes the cryptographic mass that support the system and the calculation of the addresses which will hold the value or the assets, it just makes the whole system much more complex and much more secure in practice. So we talk about elliptic curve cryptography. It just gives us additional intersection points on a graph so that we can work with the mass and we can create these slightly more, or very, very much more complex cryptographic controls. The private key is then where you hold the item as such. It's not actually the Bitcoin, it's the entry which evidences whatever that property entitlement is. Title transfer. We can either have a transaction system or we can have an account system. With a transaction model like Bitcoin, the blockchain only is a long record of transfers. So we have what we call the origin block when the first Bitcoin were created at the very beginning. That was the first 50 Bitcoin that were mined. After the first 10 minutes, the first person, that was Satoshi Nakamoto, earned, generated, received 50 Bitcoin at the end of the first 10 minutes when the program was switched on. That's called the origination block. All of those transaction records since are then recorded on the blockchain. The blockchain is only a record of transfers. At any one point in time, it doesn't actually provide an account balance. Alternative systems such as Ethereum operate through what we call states, and they can have an account figure, balance. They can show what you own in terms of a balance value. So if you open your account on Ethereum, it will say you've got so many Ethereum or maybe so many other assets of any form. So we can operate on either a simple basic transaction record system like Bitcoin, or we can work on an account-based system, one or the other. The account-based models just tend to be a bit more complex. If they're more complex, they just take longer to operate, which means it slows them down, so there may be scalability issues there as well. The big issue with a lot of this is trying to scale it up. Bitcoin is very clever, it's very effective mathematically, but it's very slow. As we've said already, you can only carry out 7 Bitcoin transactions per second. With MasterCard and Visa, you can do 26,000 per second. We still have this massive scalability problem with Bitcoin. So there's two types of title transfer, either a transaction system or an account system. We then have transaction hashing. We want to keep a secure record of every transaction, so we're going to run it through a hash. Bitcoin uses SHA-256. That's the most commonly used hash function. It's called SHA-256. That means secure hash algorithm, SHA. There's various different types of hash algorithm. There's 256, there's half of that, 126, and then there's like double that, 512. But there's various hash algorithms, and what they simply do is this, they produce a result. The result is a bit address. It's zeros and ones, it's numbers, uppercase and lowercase letters, excluding zero and L, because excluding O and L, because O and L are too close to zero and one. So we exclude O and L, but it can be a mixture of lowercase letters, uppercase letters, and numbers. These are these alphanumeric addresses you see. These are called hashes. What happens is this, you run any message, any entry through a hash, and it produces this result. The length of the result is determined by the number of the hash. So hash 256 will produce a 250-bit hash. That's what you'll see very often if you go online or you're looking at systems or you see something on the internet. That long alphanumeric number, that's the hash. The hashes are infeasible. And what that means is this. Anything can be hashed so long as it's digital. But once it's hashed, you can never reverse the hash. You can never use the hash function to calculate the original message. This is why they're so secure. This is why this is very useful. So we have both cryptographic access control using the private keys, and we also have transaction hashing. This is what makes these systems very valuable indeed, very secure. So even though we have, going back to our earlier point about multiple points of access and possible multiple points of theory, and multiple points of failure in theory, in practice that's highly limited because of the controls on the cryptographic access and then on the transaction hashing. In a blockchain, all transactions are hashed. So every time you do a transfer, who owns that new value and the address will be hashed. So what we're going to do is this. We're going to hold all the hashes in the blockchain. With blockchain, we have a limit, whether it's a time limit or a transaction number limit. In Bitcoin, it's 10 minutes, as we've said already. So every 10 minutes, we're going to run all the transaction hashes, and then we're going to close the block. Now, what they do is this. We use what we call a Merkle tree. In Bitcoin, this is after Frank Merkle, a famous American mathematician. It's like an inverted tree, like a pyramid, an inverted pyramid. And all the transactions that we've just run, we hash. So we get a series of hash records in a long line. Let's assume there's 2,000 transactions in the last 10 minutes on Bitcoin. Could be anything between 1.5 up to 4,000. Now, technically, you can work it out because it's like seven seconds in 10 minutes. You can work it out that way. But let's assume we have 2,000 transactions in the last 10 minutes. What we do is this. We put all the hashes in a long line. And then we hash them in pairs. So 1 and 2, 3 and 4, 5 and 6, 7 and 8 are hashed in pairs to create another line. And then we hash those in pairs to create the next line, then the next line, then the next line, all the way down till we get the root. That's the root of the tree. We call that the Merkle root, the root hash. If there's an odd number on any line, we hash the transaction with itself. So if there's 51, we hash 50, then the last one is hashed with itself. We calculate, we run that all the way down to the bottom hash. That's called the Merkle root. What we do is this. The award system proof of work in Bitcoin simply operates by the miners competing to calculate the hash root. But that's actually quite easy to do. So what they have to do is this. They have to calculate a value below the hash root. So they're going to calculate this hash figure, but in practice what we do is this. We want a number below that. So what they have to do is this. They have to run a number of arbitrary transactions by just inserting an additional number. We call that the nonce. And you actually have to run hundreds of thousands, millions, even trillions of calculations to run the Merkle root with all the with a nonce, run it again through the hash to get a number below the Merkle root. So we can calculate the Merkle root simply, but we need to calculate a number below that. So what we do is this, we add additional figures in, additional numbers called nonces, and then we just run the transactions again until by accident we get a number below. The first computer, the first node to do that, wins the award, the reward, which is the free Bitcoin. It was 50, then every 4 years it halves. 50, 25, 12 and a half, 6 1/4. So we have the transaction hashing. The verification then is the first node to calculate and validate the transactions and close the block. That's what we call the verification or the consensus. And what the miners are essentially doing, they're running proof of work. Proof of work is proving that you've calculated, you've applied a certain amount of effort, proving that you've expended a certain amount of computer time, principally in terms of electricity and computational power. That's what generates your entitlement to the reward. So we're going to hash the transactions, and then we're going to run them in this Merkle tree to calculate the hash root. But what we do is we have to have a number below the hash root, and we do that by inserting additional arbitrary numbers in, which we call the nonces. And this is all done through algorithms, it's all done through computers, and these million nodes around the world are competing so that every 10 minutes, who's the fastest? And the one that's the fastest to get this figure below this Merkle root amount gets the reward. That will then determine the transactions which are to be validated. We then verify the block at that time by that node. The block's then locked. The Merkle root is used mathematically as the link that ties the blocks together. So how do you connect these blocks in a chain? You use the Merkle root. That's the mathematical link, because the Merkle root goes in as part of the header for the next block before you then run all the hashes again for the next transaction set. So blocking and locking. What we're doing is this: with blockchain, we have sets of transactions. We do this on a time basis. With blockchain, it's 10 minutes. As I said before, Litecoin, I think it's 2 minutes. You close the block, you determine all the transactions in it, you run the hashes, you create the Merkle root with the Merkle tree, and then you use that as the connector between the blocks. That's blockchain. We then lock and close the blocks. The problem is this does take time. That's why the system is quite slow. We can only run up to 7 transactions per minute. There are devices for improving this, and we call that specifically the most useful tool that Bitcoin has. It's called the Lightning Network, whereby we can carry out transactions off the chain and just run them in chains, run them in sequential numbers, and then put them back on. But that does take time, and it is still inefficient. The possible future, more valuable technology is what we call graph technology, whereby instead of having blocks that we lock and close, we just have long transaction chains. We call that graph technology. It's a directed acyclic graph, which means it goes in one direction. Acyclic means it cannot loop back, and it's just a chain of events, a chain of entries. The wallets, as we've mentioned already, the wallets don't hold the amount, they don't hold the value, they hold the private cryptographic key, which accesses the entry, which determines what the value is. So there is actually no value. There's nothing of any value whatsoever in this system. It's just entries which record a figure, and that figure is what the market determines the Bitcoin to be worth on that particular day. It's just entries, and it's those entries which are held on the blockchain. As we said, you have hard wallets and cold wallets, hot wallets and warm wallets or cold wallets. Interoperability is whereby we consider to what extent we can move value between blockchains. Most blockchains, all the early ones, were designed specifically to only exist by themselves. It's just a long chain of transactions. That's the blocks. The blocks get longer all the way through. Blockchains, possibly 21,000, even more now. Blocks. With between 2 and up to just over 4,000 transactions in each block.
So it's just a long blockchain. It's then not possible to transfer value. We're designing new types of coins which actually provide for this, allow for this. That's specifically what Metronome was designed to do. There's a technical device called an atomic swap. If you have two long blockchains, you can create temporary accounts on each one. You'll debit one value, you'll increase the other value. If the transaction goes through, for example, you buy a car for 10 Bitcoin, or you buy a house for 1,000 Bitcoin, all you do is you transfer the values. It's the same as bank account transfers, including, for example, under the international SWIFT system, which is simply a messaging system. All you're doing is, on one entry, you reduce the value, on another, you increase the value. It's atomistic, which means if the condition's not determined, the whole transaction cancels, everything closes out. All the temporary accounts are terminated. It's an atomic swap. You're swapping values on an atomistic basis, called an atomic swap. We also then have to consider code control and governance. The code is the underlying computer language in which the specific blockchain is written. All we're doing is using existing main principle computer codes, so we can look to see what was any particular Bitcoin or Ethereum or whatever else, what was it written in, what was the underlying code that they used. And then the governance is the decision-taking structure that determines how all of the participants in the system can vote or take decisions. Basically, with the core model, it's basically one member, one vote. So every node on the Bitcoin system which is participating on the blockchain has a vote. Now, that sounds very democratic, it sounds very fair, it sounds very reasonable, very egalitarian, it's based on equality, democracy. But the problem is, in practice, it's very inefficient because the nodes are disagreeing and fighting all of the time. You've got nodes in Russia, you've got nodes in China, you've got nodes in North America. How do they agree on what they're going to do? A lot of the early problem with Bitcoin was deciding, shall we have these what we call hard forks or soft forks? They wanted to update the system, they wanted to make the technology better, the coding to be improved, but they couldn't agree how to do this. So there was like Sedgwick and various other systems and disputes. We have at least three hard forks now of Bitcoin, which are revisions to the core original Bitcoin blockchain, which have then been solidified and then last forever. We also have other soft forks, which simply work on... it's not a temporary basis. They're like less important, less material revisions which will change going forward but not going back. So there's this 4, 5, 6 different types of Bitcoin now, depending upon whether you buy and sell the original Bitcoin or one of the hard forks or one of the soft forks. So there are these different systems as well we need to look at. The main problem is creating an effective governance system. Essentially, what we will have to do over time is move to some form of quasi-corporate body type mechanism, whereby we have senior managers, we have managers, possibly even a senior director, and we have voting through a management group. If we're going to have very large open systems, like with Bitcoin, with, as we've said already, up to maybe 1 million nodes, it's very complex and it's very difficult to run all of this. Almost impossible to take decisions, especially when something of a quite a difficult and sensitive nature comes up. And that's been one of the main problems with Bitcoin, being able to take decisions and to improve and bring forward, innovate, using all of the new technology, ideas that might be available. Very often we can't implement that simply because we can't get effective agreement on this. What I do then do with the rest of these slides is basically move on to look at different aspects of this new world. In terms of Bitcoin replacing money, the argument was that Bitcoin was the future of money, it could replace fiat currencies. That will not happen. That's not appropriate, that's not relevant. The system is too complex. There's already, from this slide, and this is slightly older, 380,000 blocks. There's probably over 400,000 blocks now. it's at least 45 gigabytes. It's now too large. You cannot hold it on your phone or even a laptop. Very often it has to be a desktop now, simply because the blockchain is too big, which of itself creates its own inefficiency. It's too slow. 7 per second. Tangle, that's the DAG operated by IOTA, we've mentioned already. That's trying to make this much faster. The mechanism that we mentioned before with Lightning on Bitcoin is also of use, but still it doesn't deal with this fundamental scalability problem. Too slow to amend. The blocks are too small, which means they can't actually hold a lot of data. One of the key revisions in moving from Bitcoin to Ethereum, and this was Vitalik Buterin, a Russian-American programmer, what he wanted to do was make the block size bigger so they could include what we call automatic smart contracts or automated functions. So instead of the coin just being an item of value, it can actually do things. It could performance, it could have a utility function. So that's the basis for what we call smart contracts. That grew specifically because with Ethereum, they wanted to extend the block size so they could include additional coding rather than simply have a basic value. There's also massive computational waste. The thing is just too big. It uses far too much electricity, energy. It's a waste of power. Why do we have 1 million Bitcoin nodes all around the world computing arbitrary transaction sizes to calculate the Merkle root and a number below the Merkle root using nonsense, when these could be used for much more productive, you know, other functions in any society? Lack of transparency, lack of effective governance and oversight, susceptibility to attack. Strictly speaking, if you controlled over 51% of the computing power, you could manipulate the figures. Nobody will do that in practice. So it's a theoretical threat, but it's still relevant. We have to consider that. More likely what could happen is you could have malware. So it's not that you could take control. Possibly you could, but you could certainly destroy the system if you wanted to quite quickly. So even though there's a million nodes and it's decentralized, if you were able to damage all of those nodes, you could undermine the effectiveness of the system as such. Technically, there's possibly a way of taking control if you can manage 51%. In practice, what happens is all these nodes don't operate individually. They have guilds or pools. So, you know, 1,000, 10,000, 20,000 may come together. They have different names, slush pool, and there's various others. They're like guilds or pools, so that nodes come together in groups so they can share the rewards and they can work together to try and be more effective as a team to calculate the relevant figures. Massive technological dependence. This is very complex. I am told there's possibly 50 people in the whole world who understand Bitcoin. It's a huge problem, which means we're totally dependent on techies, on specialist technical experts who actually understand this, who can fix it, who correct it if anything goes wrong. And that's not good. In a population of global, world population of 7.234 billion, we can't be completely dependent on a very small group of specialists in any core area of technology. There's no regulation, there's no deposit protection, there's no lender of last resort, and then we have massive price volatility and instability. So is Bitcoin the future of money, the future of coinage, the future of currency? No, for all these reasons. But still, there's a lot of very useful technology in here which could be over time. What I then do in the rest of the slides is focus on other specific elements of this, and we can come back and talk about all of this in future detail. We've got central bank digital currency. This will have the biggest impact on private digital currencies. CBDC can bring all of the advantages of technology, all the power, the speed, the innovation, the decentralization, all of the attractive nature features of the private coin market, but it can do it in a very safe, stable, secure way with full government support, government guarantee, government cover, lender of last resort, regulation. So when a digital dollar, a digital euro, digital sterling, and these other digital currencies come, we expect to see the private coin market reduce quite substantially. Not completely ever. simply because a lot of the people who are buying these digital coins, they are part of this original cypherpunk movement, or, I mean, this kind of general anti-government, anti-central banking, anti-Federal Reserve, anti-currency type culture. So they will always buy this. Even when the digital dollar comes, they will think that threatens their rights even more, which in some countries, for example, in China, it will. Because they will simply tie the digital currency system into the surveillance system, the social credit security system, and all other forms of political control. So we can see all of this coming. The issue that simply arises with central bank digital currency is that the central banks, and the government through the central bank, will become the largest holders of private data in every country. Because they'll be able to monitor every transaction that you take and you make from when you're born till you die. And all of that will be on a record system that the central bank will own, the central bank will control. This brings massive responsibility in terms of data protection and data management going forward. The other massive problem that it creates, I've summarised all of this, I have a longer paper on this which has been published just now, 40,000 words. The other big impact simply is this. If we transfer all of the core monetary functions in a monetary system to the central bank, we effectively destroy the commercial bank sector. Why do we need commercial banks? Now, can we actually do that? Because what that would mean is this. All of the administrative functions that banks carry out in managing all of our private bank accounts, as well as all the credit assessment and credit management processes that banks undertake, all of that would disappear and have to be transferred to the central bank. It just can't work. It will not happen. The central banks don't want to set this up on a decentralized basis. What they want to do is, they want to have it highly centralized. Rather than use Bitcoin, rather than use open permissionless Bitcoins, the major central banks such as the Bank of England, European Central Bank and the Federal Reserve, they want to run this in a highly centralized system. What they will effectively do is open up their balance sheets. So if you buy a digital dollar, you will essentially be put onto the New York, the Federal Reserve Bank system in America. Rather than have it like an open permissionless system as with Bitcoin, it will be a highly centralized system. Smaller countries will use an open permissionless model like Bitcoin. So we already have this operating in Lithuania, in Barbados. Other countries are looking at it, such as Jamaica. They will use the Bitcoin model. Bitcoin is open and permissionless. That means that anyone can participate, anyone can be a member, anyone can download the software, download the blockchain, and then participate as a node. That's an open permissionless system. With the big central banks, what they will do is they will move on to a closed permission model. So although they will use a lot of the other benefits of the distributed ledger technology model, it won't be distributed. It won't be decentralized. It will be highly centralized. So that's what we're seeing with a lot of these major innovations in this area. The point simply is, the central banks could become the largest holders of personal data in the country, with massive responsibility that brings, as well as, if it is highly centralized, this could destroy the effective function of the commercial bank sector in almost any economy. Let me just finish some stuff, then we'll take some questions. So, I've basically constructed a model for how central bank digital currency could work, and we can come back and look at that. It's in the paper, if anybody's interested. We've also then got this idea of big tech and super tech. What almost happened was Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, which was originally set up in 2004, but then renamed Meta in 2021, almost built the first global super coin. It was called Libra, then renamed DM, with its own wallet system called Calibra. This could have worked. But through WhatsApp, Instagram, and Facebook, Zuckerberg would have provided accounts to a third of the world. The central banks did not like this. Many countries, many governments did not like this. And so a large number of efforts were made basically to make sure this didn't work. But this could have been enormous. Now, the fact that Libra coin, then renamed DM, didn't work
It was sold at the beginning of 2022 to a California bank called Silvergate for $200 million. The fact that it didn't work doesn't matter. We still have this issue with these big super coins and super tech, super apps. We still have the WeChats. We still have these other very big, powerful applications. Even if it's not a coin just now, it could be later. If WeChat had not been in China, WeChat will have its own payment system almost immediately. Well, WeChat already does have a payment system. Alipay is the payment system for Alibaba. What's now happening is the Chinese want to centralize the central bank digital control using their, it's called the DCEP, Digital Currency Electronic Payment Model. They will not allow any other technology company in China to develop this. But otherwise, if it hadn't been for that control, this could have happened. WeChat could have had its own digital coin, WeCoin, or ChatCoin, or something. This is still coming. We need to monitor this. We need to watch this. The power of these very big, massively used applications all around the world. They've raised very significant issues, not just from a regulatory perspective, but from competition, monetary policy, financial stability, financial integrity, financial crime, taxation, all sorts of different issues that we have to consider together for the first time. So this is just beginning. We will see this very big, powerful, super apps, super coins, super technologies all coming. And what we need to do is develop a new set of regulatory systems to deal with this. And that's the different policy issues that I've mentioned there. We've also got what we call decentralized applications, or dApps. The online world will be governed, dominated by dApps. They're all coming. Decentralized applications. The first one was Ethereum, we've mentioned already. The whole purpose, this was Vitalik Buterin's idea. It was to extend the block size on Bitcoin so that we could create code function inside the blockchain. These are smart contracts, code functions. We can do all sorts of utility functions inside the blockchain using these computer-coded smart contracts. That's the beginning for all of this. This will be enormous. Very quickly, large numbers of traditional commercial contracts that we deal with commonly on a daily basis that we may otherwise draft and use, sign, execute, whatever, all of this will become fully automated using these dApps. This is all coming. This is the new world. The more complex version of that are these smart contracts. This originally began with Nick Szabo. Nick Szabo, the American computer programmer, some people consider maybe part of the original team of Satoshi Nakamoto, if not be Satoshi Nakamoto himself. He developed a lot of these early ideas. There's a famous paper that he published that we'll put on the system. An example. We already have a number of coins and tokens using this, Ethereum, Cardano, Solana, IOTA. They're all beginning to look at how we can use basically extended forms of these dApps, extended forms of automated computer-generated, computer-run contracts, so that the contracts run themselves. And in future, this could become common very daily. What will happen is, one program will collect money from your account. It will invest that, and then when a payment has to be made out, it will make the payment. Or it will take money from your bank account to pay something else for another thing for your other account, for your car account, or to have your car serviced, or whatever else. All of this is coming. Everything's going to become increasingly fully automated using these smart contracts. You'll have an electric car. The car will basically fill itself up with, well, it'll be electric, so it will charge itself, and then it will pay for the charging. And then it will take itself to the garage to get serviced, and then it will pay for that, and it will pay for its own insurance. And if there's an accident, it will make sure there's a separate app, smart contract, which will deal with the payment because it scraped someone's car. And this is all coming. It will all be run through computers, all be run through automated contracts. Decentralized finance. Traditional finance is highly intermediated. We use banks as the center of the system and the center of the financial model. These are the key intermediaries. They bring surplus assets together, they make that available in deficit parts of society which need the money. All of that's going to go. Decentralized finance, people come together online, direct contact, and they can provide funds through various types of new type of app. We can see it for charitable purposes, but it's also been extended in all sorts of other areas. This is growing very fast, very quickly indeed. Some of the most common examples, Aave, Synthetics, REN, Kyber, Ox, Bancor,
All of this is coming, and it's growing very fast, and it's very powerful. NFTs, non-fungible tokens. The key point is that we create a unique, non-interchangeable data entry point. A Bitcoin is fungible. Although technically it is a finite, specific, dedicated address, which will be in your private wallet that we mentioned before, the whole point of these non-fungible tokens is that that becomes specific, dedicated property. A Bitcoin is valuable and can be exchanged for other items of the same value. This is non-fungible. So what happens is this, non-fungible tokens, you cannot exchange this. So you buy a specific item, such as, for example, a piece of art. And what they've done is this. I mean, this is Beeple Everydays. This is one of the first major pieces of art. What's it worth? 38,000 Ethereum. That's what it was sold for. What's that? 69 million. And there's a large number of these. I've actually built on the system a gallery. I have my own gallery, my own NFT gallery. 28 million. 6 million. And I'll show you more. I've got a whole gallery of this I'm working on. Very, very interesting indeed. So what you're doing is this. You're buying non-exchangeable, non-fungible elements. Basically, what will happen is they create an item of art or property or something else of valuable, and then they cut it up into lots of digital sections. It might be 100, might be 1,000, might be 10,000. You buy one of those. So you buy element 269 or element 341. That's your non-fungible token. It's a portion of this major, larger piece of art. This is becoming enormous. It's going to become very large, and it's going to explode even further. Why was Zuckerberg not that disappointed to have to sell his own digital coin, Libra, DM? Because he's now looking at the metaverse. And what's Libra, what's Facebook going to do on the metaverse? Now Meta, that's why it named itself Meta, NFTs. It doesn't need the coin, it'll let someone else do that. It's going to buy and sell NFTs. And what will happen is your Facebook page, your Meta page in future, everybody will just show off their NFTs. And you'll even turn your own photographs, your own life into NFTs. This is all coming. We can't even begin to predict how this will grow and expand. But developers, programmers like Zuckerberg think this will be enormous. This will be a really big part of the metaverse. There are a whole series of difficult legal issues. We do not know what these things are in law. We cannot explain them in law. There's a whole series of rights. Digital information, digital data, digital property, digital classification. Do you actually own it, or do you just have a license? And then replication and dilution. Can the artist just make a copy? What does that do to yours? If you've just spent 69 million, we saw, buying something, what if the artist makes a copy? Because if you've only got a replicant, a duplicate, and you've got no control over the original copying of that, it will completely dilute your value. Issues with copyright. And can you divide copyright? We don't even know that in many legal systems. Who owns the copyright? The original artist. Can you buy that? We still don't know. That will be in the contract for the NFT that you purchase. But even if you could buy the copyright, can you then split copyright up into 10,000 separate elements? We just don't know. A large number of difficult issues here. Inheritance, what we call data integrity or link rot. Link rot is the digital link to your item. What if for some reason that gets corrupted in some way? A digit gets moved or misplaced or whatever, or misforms itself somehow because of malware or something else, or with copying or just age. Link rot means you've got a £69 million NFT that becomes inaccessible, non-transferable, useless in value. So a whole series of difficult things coming with these NFTs, but this market is going to explode. A lot of people are spending a lot of money in this. As I said, I've got about 20 of these. I've got a gallery I'm building up. Then decentralized exchanges. We will look at stock markets and exchanges as formerly full centralized exchanges, but we've also got these DEX coming. DEX are basically computer programs that buy and sell assets, and it could be any types of digital asset, digital security, or anything else of any form. These are all coming. DEXs. I mentioned some of them here. Some of the problems. Basically, order book matching. There's very limited liquidity on these markets. We try to improve that through what's called automated market makers, AMMs, which are just algorithms. but still, a lot of people are making a lot of money on these things, but you have to be careful, you have to know what you're doing. It's an easy way to have a substantial loss. The two big problems with DEXs and with the NFT and the DeFi is basically you don't know who you're dealing with. And that's where digital identity becomes the key thing. You could be dealing with a robot, a criminal, a Chinese criminal gang, a Russian criminal gang, or a dog. You don't know online who you're dealing with. That's why we go back to the other points we made at the beginning with the template. Digital identity is going to become absolutely crucial going forward. You need to know who you're dealing with, or else how can you trust these systems? Why would you possibly think of putting a large amount of money into these markets when you don't know who you're dealing with? When there's no regulation, there's no support, there's no cover, there's no formal control of any manner. They're important, they're exciting, they're growing very, very fast, but we need to be very, very careful. DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations. What we're actually building now is this. It's digital communities. And this could be a company, it could be a local community, a social group, or it could be a large multinational corporation, or it could even be a country. There's actually websites building nation-state DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations. It goes back to this idea of smart contract again. You basically use computer code and controls and programming to create communities. You define all the rights and obligations of the communities in the code, and then you can run the system using this. The most famous DAO was actually set up when Ethereum was launched back in around 2016. Ethereum was then worth around $150 billion. A hacker was able, through published defects in the original Ethereum code, to extract $50 billion. So the first DAO that was set up to raise money for Ethereum raised $150 million, and somebody stole $50 million of that. And this created a huge debate in this online community, which still goes on, and the whole question simply was this. Well, it's not theft if a flaw, a defect, a programming error allowed me to extract that money, therefore it's not theft, I didn't steal it. And this caused a big problem, a big issue. And what actually happened was we split Ethereum. So we now have Ethereum and we have Ethereum Classic. Ethereum Classic is the original Ethereum that was created before the DAO, and Ethereum Classic, that's Ethereum Classic, the Ethereum that we talk about, actually hard forked, went back, removed this value and recreated the $50 billion that had been stolen. But this caused a lot of confusion, a lot of conflict, a lot of disagreement in the community, because a lot of the programmers said, well, if it was available, if the program allowed it to be done, you can't criticize that, you can't stop that. And already that had been published on the systems and on the blogs and the vlogs and the everything else, the community that had been discussing all of this. People knew it was vulnerable. So a lot of people said, well, that's not theft. It was a defect. Someone legitimately moved value, possibly just to show that the defect was legitimate. This will be important again, because back to this idea of automation, of smart contracts, and how a lot of this will come together over time. We've then got the metaverse and the multinet. Already online, you can decentralize land. You can buy land now already. You can buy land and you can build houses. You can build companies, corporations, anything you like, stadiums. Decentralized, Uplink, Fortnite, Sandbox, Exe, Linden Labs, Second Life. All of this is already there. The metaverse is going to pull all of this together. The key is this. These all exist as separate worlds on the metaverse just now, but we will create a multi-net. We will bring all these worlds together. We'll have a single point of entry using the cryptography I mentioned at the beginning. You'll have a single avatar, and then all the systems will be connected with each other, so you'll be able to move. So your avatar will just move through all these different worlds, different places, different spaces. This is all coming. It's also going to use haptics and 3D systems. So, for example, Meta's already, Facebook's already selling. It's called Quest Pro. It's their headset, $1,500. And you can enter, it's called Horizon. You can enter the Meta world already. This is just the opening, just the beginning of this. But later on, what will happen is you'll be able to plug yourself in. And this is what Neuralink, Elon Musk, is developing just now. programs whereby you can actually plug yourself. A robot inserts 6-inch wires into your brain, and you have a little socket. And you literally plug a wire into the socket, plug it into a computer. It could be the largest, most powerful supercomputer in the world. This is all coming. And then very quickly, you won't even need to plug yourself in. They're actually developing systems which can do all this on a non-invasive basis. So the future of Facebook's, Zuckerberg's goggle system I mentioned already, the future of that is to actually read brainwaves. So you'll actually participate in this without even having to plug your head in. It's all coming. It's all coming very quickly, very powerful. The idea of the metaverse began with Neil Stephenson, Snow Crash 1992, this Horizon and Meta's Quest Pro. Facebook was originally set up for January 2009, renamed Meta Platforms, 28 October 2021. This is all coming. Continuity, interoperability, single access, portability, multi-layer functionality, 3D capacity. It's a combination of AR, artificial reality, VR, virtual reality. We're going to create new forms of mixed reality, mixed consciousness, mixed sentience. It's all coming. We're only at the very beginning. The question simply is, what legal issues does this raise? How do we manage it? How do we control it? How do we create a new meta law inside the metaverse? Can we reuse the existing laws? Or do we actually have to design a new set of legal provisions, codes and principles? We don't know. We haven't even begun to think about the issues which actually arise at this time. The rest of the slides then finish up on looking at new technology, new digital transformation, understanding all of the new technology. Everything in terms of new innovation we can break down to about six core ideas: energy and alternative energy, transportation and propulsion, building and construction, manufacturing and production, land use agriculture, carbon management, power, propulsion, premises, production, planning and protection. We can reduce all the physical technologies to six simple ideas. We can then have two sets of digital technologies: digital fusion reaction, quantum computing, digital connection, cloud networks, blockchain and graph technology, rebuilding the internet, rebuilding the World Wide Web. Web 3, Web 4, Web 5. What we're moving on to is this: a fully immersive sensory internet, and that's the metaverse. We will literally live inside this. That's the future of the internet. The internet will not be separate apart from us. We will actually live inside it on a daily basis, and this is all coming very quickly. In terms of that's infrastructure technologies, digital infrastructure, we've also got digital applied technologies. Digital coding and automation, big data, crypto and blockchain, robotics, nanotechnology, machine reading, machine learning, artificial intelligence, machine sentience. All of this is coming. We're going to build the most powerful supercomputers in the world. The question is, should they become people? Should we give them legal personality? We're going to build computers very quickly, more powerful than anything man could ever have done or will ever do. Are they going to be people? We don't know. My own opinion? No. These will always stay tools, machines. So we have to design a whole liability system. These very powerful new supercomputers that are going to run the world very quickly, if not take over the world very quickly. We have to work out a whole series of new liability rules to manage all of this. And then also, in terms of larger global technology, we need to look at social technology, trade technology, climate technology, regulatory technology, tech, controlling AI and robotics, and then war technology. We have lethal autonomous weapons. What's happening now is armies are disappearing because we don't need them anymore. Everything in future, laws, lethal autonomous weapons, will be biotechnology and nanotechnology. We have big, powerful treaties on the use of bioweapons, but a lot of people just ignore them anyway. But we don't have anything on nanoweapons. So what are all the key military centres, key military research teams, and all the main countries in the world doing just now? Nanobots, nanorobots. That's the future of weaponry. That's the future of warfare. And it's all coming. We're building a new world that we don't understand, that we can't control, and that we're not going to be able to manage unless we begin to think about the core issues,
think about the core problems and begin to design a new series of standards, principles and codes. I'm going to set these out in what I call protocols. Why? Because protocol is a useful, it's a diplomatic device. It can have legal effect or it may not have legal effect. So the protocols I want to draft, prepare, and I'm actually working on this, will have legal sections, non-legal regulatory sections, guidance sections, aspirational sections, and then actual code, where we can automate and we can use smart contracts and code, we'll put that in as well. We need protocols in all the key new areas that we're building. Lethal autonomous weapons, nanotech, biotech, AI, robotics, cybernetics, human interface, machine interface, all of this stuff, as well as dealing with crisis, dealing with the climate crisis, dealing with the coronavirus crisis, dealing with future pandemic events, dealing with any type of major endogenous, internal, exogenous, external, and potentially existential threat. All of this is coming, and we need to have the necessary systems in place to be able to deal with this. The point is, we do live in a single world. We have single global challenges, and if we cannot manage them on a collective common basis, we just will not be able to deal and respond to the threats that are coming. This is called the Anthropocene or the Anthropogenic Era, which means man-made. Man is the sixth extinction event. It's not that the planet won't survive, the planet will survive. The question is, can we? And within 50 to 100 years, we may not be here. There's a large number of very significant, powerful, as I've said, endogenous, exogenous, and existential threats. And if we cannot manage them, if we cannot find a way of coming together on a global basis to deal with these common collective global challenges, this is the sixth extinction event.